Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. America could use a Barbara Jordan today, but alas, there was only one Barbara Jordan. And since she left public office and then this mortal plane, there has been no one like her since. But what made that young girl from the Fifth Ward of Houston become the keeper of the flame of democracy, of justice, and of the Constitution? I hope to find out about that in our hour today. But first, let's hear from Congresswoman Jordan when the rest of the nation learned what Texas already knew at the Watergate hearings.
Earlier today, we heard the beginning of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. We the people. It's a very eloquent beginning. But when that document was completed on the 17th of September in 1787, I was not included in that we the people. I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in we the people. Today, I am an inquisitor. And hyperbole would not be fictional and would not overstate the solemnness that I feel right now. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution.
We're joined by Mary Ellen Curtin. She has written a new biography of Barbara Jordan. She changed the nation. Barbara Jordan's life and legacy in black politics. Mary Ellen Curtin, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Why did you decide to take up telling the story of Barbara Jordan?
Right. Thank you so much. Well, it seemed to me that she had not been properly appreciated, and that her role in the civil rights movement and the Black freedom struggle in the 20th century really needed to be highlighted and evaluated and explained. So that was my initial question, right? How does she fit into this broader story of civil rights and the Black freedom movement in the 20th century? And so in the book, I really try and give a portrait of the people and institutions in Houston who shaped her during segregation, and explain how and why she became an activist, which is something that's not really known or understood about her, and the role that she played in the Black freedom struggle as the struggle moved from the streets into the State House and Congress. Being a Black elected official was absolutely new terrain for the civil rights movement. You have to remember that in 1960, you didn't have a single Black representative in any Southern state legislatures. So, you know, doing what she did, being elected to the Senate, was something new. And changes, you know, that had excluded Black people from politics, that can't shift overnight. It's going to take time. Elected officials can't be mandated. You can't pass a law that demands, right, a quota of Black elected officials. But you can put into place legislation that makes the voting process fair and open and meaningful. And so my book really spends a lot of time talking about Jordan in Texas and how she created an organization, raised money, created alliances. And all this has to be learned. You need support. You need dedicated workers on the ground. It's a huge undertaking. And I really helped to explain why Black Houston, of all the cities in the South, had a structure in place that allowed someone like Jordan to emerge relatively early, before the Voting Rights Act, as a Black politician and Black leader. And I also discussed the significance of her time working with labor and liberals in a coalition to get elected, and then in the Texas Senate, where I would say that she learned from her colleagues in that setting a lot about governance and how to work within an institution like Congress, and particularly the Judiciary Committee during Watergate. You have to remember that the 70s was a decade when the movement is moving into politics. You've got new Black voters as a force with the Voting Rights Act. You've got new Black mayors. You've got new Black members of Congress. You've got new institutions like the Congressional Black Caucus is coming into its own. New think tanks like the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. The National Black Political Convention in Gary. Jordan was there. She shows up in very interesting and unexpected places, along with Black power activists and politicians. They're trying to hammer out a mutual agenda. She's a very strong Black feminist, also in the 70s, as they're finding their voice. So the more I got into the details of her life, the more I became persuaded that as compelling as her quotes are, such as the one that you just played, that there's a much bigger story here about what's happening with civil rights and Black power and Black politics in this era. And that's really what I want to get at in this book.
We can't get away with her from her voice. We have to play her voice in a program like this.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting that young people today, when I was growing up, Barbara Jordan was a household name.
Mm.
You know, like Michael Jordan, Barbara
yeah.
Jordan, you know, but not so much today, hardly at all. I mean, young people don't know. That doesn't really register.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's very unfortunate. And again, I think recasting her and telling more about her personal life, her private life, her goals, her relationship to that movement really helps to take her out of sort of like a two-dimensional sort of hero approach, which after a while, like if you weren't there, you can't really appreciate it. So there's, you know, wonderful statues of her, you know, but those statues don't really convey, right, the significance of her breakthrough and how she really helped people to imagine a time when a Black woman, like we're seeing today, right, could be president, serve on the Supreme Court, be a real leader in changing the nation. Black women, you know, their leadership had not been fully appreciated in the civil rights movement. And I think, you know, her explosion on the scene was a real breakthrough. The problem is that over time, she became, in a way, you know, this was a source of criticism of her, part of a system that she was also seeking to critique, right? And we see this with politicians today, like how do you navigate that tension? And as a way of being effective, you know, she really stressed a lot about her patriotism. So sometimes she comes off perhaps as a more conservative or two-dimensional character than she really was. And I think once we get into understanding her experience, her goals, her personhood, then I think that she can speak to this new generation that you're talking about.
You mentioned statues. There's a statue of her at the University of Texas at Austin campus. Mm. She was not allowed to go to school there because of Texas Jim Crow. UT Austin at that time was a whites-only campus. I don't know if they mentioned that in the plaque. But eventually she would teach there at the LBJ School of Government. We're going to talk more about Barbara Jordan. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What are your memories of Barbara Jordan? What do you think she would be saying today? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Mary Ellen Curtin. She is a historian and a professor of modern African American and women's social and political history at the American University in Washington, D.C. Her new book is She Changed the Nation, Barbara Jordan's Life and Legacy in Black Politics. You can call in with your questions and comments at 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to a caller now. We have Kitty on the line. Kitty, you're on the air. Hi, Kitty. Can you hear me?
Hi, you caught me. I was doing stuff in the kitchen.
All right. Here we are. Yes, you're on the air.
I think that Barbara Jordan was one of our most fantastic representatives for the state of Texas. And I think she would have eviscerated Trump at the very beginning of his desire to become president of the United States. And he wouldn't have probably known what to do with her because she was black and she was a woman and she was brilliant.
Well, Katie, thank you for those comments and calling in. We appreciate that. So Mary Ellen Curtin, the story is that when Barbara Jordan got to the Texas Senate, and of course she was the only black woman there, but she was a force and would not be, just took on the whole Texas Senate. And they drove them nuts. And they basically created a congressional district specifically for her to get rid of her.
Well, that's one interpretation, to be sure. But I also think it's important to understand that politics in general is being changed because of redistricting laws. And so for the first time, even though you have a one-party system, the Democrats, right, in Texas, it's divided. And so you have a liberal wing and a conservative wing. And she's definitely with the liberals, and who are also white men, and they're liberals and they're labor leaders, and they want to change the conservative control of the Democratic Party and of the state. They stand for things like fairer taxation. They stand for things like a corporate tax, corporate income tax. And so one of the reasons Jordan was able to have her voice heard, right, in that setting was because she had these liberal allies from the Democratic coalition. This coalition couldn't always stick together. They weren't always as effective as they wanted to be, but they were there. And you have to put her within that context that redistricting, right, is allowing more liberal folk to be elected, and that is having an impact. So, yeah. They are trying to stave off, particularly this corporate income tax, which almost passes in 1972, before she goes to Congress. She definitely did have support among certain elites in the Democratic Party, such as Ben Barnes, but not everyone, not everyone. So there is a healthy debate about why she was put forward for this, 18th congressional district. I think, though, in general, the Democratic Party at the time, believe it or not, really was becoming more aware of the power of the black vote. And they wanted someone, right, to show that Texas was going to be at the forefront of this new era. Also, Texas at the time, they passed the Equal Rights Amendment. They were one of the first states to do that. So it's a different time. Liberalism, becoming more of a political force, and I think she's part of that broader change.
Well, we still had Governor Connally, you know, and...
Oh, yes, they were definitely enemies. They were enemies.
And for so long, we had the whites-only primary in Texas, where only white people were allowed to vote in the Democratic primary, which
Correct.
Was basically it's like the Republican primary today. It's like the only if you win the Republican primary, then you basically won your political office in Texas. And so it was basically they controlled the game. They said they were a private club and they could decide who their members were. But there eventually was a Supreme Court decision that struck that down, and that was a sea change in Texas and for black politics in Texas.
It was, and I just want to say to your listeners that in the book I talk about the role, and very particularly of the Good Hope Missionary Baptist Church, her church. Dr. Smith, who was the dentist, Smith v. Allwright, was a member of that church, And so you really have a generational struggle here. Without that Supreme Court case that challenged the white primary, that got more blacks into the Democrat, black voters into the Democratic Party. And it really helped to set the stage for Jordan to win, for her to win a primary election. Like, and as you said, if you win that primary, you win the election.
So, I just cannot remind people enough that that was the situation that we had in Texas. Everyone, right. And when I tell people that, they're frequently shocked that this is a system that went on for decades in Texas where we prevented black people from voting.
In the primary, yes.
In the primary, which was basically, you know, the whole thing. So right. I want to play another clip. This is from, I've got several clips. This is of Barbara Jordan from the 1974 when she was the keynote speaker. And when she went out to become the speaker, there was a huge ovation for her. She talked about how this was new, that this was a big moment for her. She spends the keynote speech talking a lot about change. You talk about she changed the nation. Well, what does change mean to Barbara Jordan? And then and also, like, why is she a Democrat? She talks about that quite a bit, which is very important because we hear a lot from Republicans today claiming that she was actually a Republican. But let's listen to this clip.
I could list the many problems which Americans have. I could list the problems which cause people to feel cynical, angry, frustrated. Problems which include lack of integrity in government, the feeling that the individual no longer counts, the reality of material and spiritual poverty, the feeling that the grand American experiment is failing or has failed. I could recite these problems, and then I could sit down and offer no solutions, but I don't choose to do that either. The citizens of America expect more, deserve, and they want more than a recital of problems. We are a people in a quandary about the present. We are a people in search of our future. We are a people in search of a national community. We are a people trying not only to solve the problems of the present, unemployment, inflation, but we are attempting on a larger scale to fulfill the promise of America. We are attempting to fulfill our national purpose to create and sustain a society in which all of us are equal.
So, Mary Ellen Curtin, and your new book is She Changed the Nation, Barbara Jordan's Life and Legacy in Black Politics. She could be talking about today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so glad you played that quote. I think she would have absolutely approved of a black woman, Kamala Harris, confronting Trump and his failures. But really, the approach, right, talking about the future, talking about patriotism and how much we love the country. Jordan never wanted to cede patriotism to conservatives, right? She was fully aware of America's shortcomings, right? But at the same time, she insisted, and if you continue to listen to that speech, that the Democratic Party could be the instrument of change.
We'll get there. We have all that. We'll get there.
Okay. Yeah. And so that we are a people, that is a purposeful, use of the word we the people, right? The way that she is still echoing the Constitution, these founding documents to strike a chord, right? With what people are expecting, how they think of themselves as Americans. I think she would have loved the unity, the organization of the Democrats, and the fight, because she always anticipated you shouldn't be complacent. Before Reagan was elected, she understood that the country was getting more conservative. She said the Republican Party is ready to do battle. We'd better get ready too. I'd like to quote from speeches that your listeners might not already know. So, she absolutely was a very loyal Democrat, but she wasn't just somebody who went along, okay? She was somebody who really wanted to push the party in a particular direction so those ideals could be closer to reality.
So that speaking style, how did she develop that? Was it deliberate? I mean, it is absolutely commanding. It holds your attention. She could be reading a recipe for, you know, for vanilla pudding or something, and it would be, hold your attention. But she is saying important stuff.
Exactly. It's the content. But the delivery has a very complicated and multi-layered history. The deep tones, she says, she came from listening to her grandfather. He also has a very interesting, so you get this legacy of oppression in segregation, but her grandfather and her father and her mother were all people who really believed in the power of the word. And her grandfather had her recite for him when she was a young girl, and she learned how to command attention very early on. She was a prize-winning college debater. Thomas Friedman, her coach, is the person she credits with really coaching her about how to pronounce every, not just every syllable, but every letter in that syllable. And then I think she gets a lot from the civil rights movement, Dr. King, the repetition, the way that you put together a sentence by using synonyms, right? So you're saying the same, you're hammering home a concept by using three different but similar words. You see that a lot in her speeches, particularly in the Watergate speech in that first clip you played. And then also the legacy of Black oratory. I was not included. There's echoes of Frederick Douglass there in his 4th of July speech where he says, I am not included, right? The difference is that Jordan sees hope because she has lived through change. I was not included in that Constitution, but now I am. And that gives me, right, motivation to fight for this country and to believe in it.
So you mentioned the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Did they have communication with each other?
They did. When Jordan was first elected, it was such a wonderful thing. She was elected in 1966. She'd been running to office since 62, 64. She spoke. Dr. King asked her to come to speak before the SCLC, his organization, shortly after that. And also she had met him before, I believe, when she was a law student at Boston University, which was King's alma mater. They knew, not a close relationship, but they had people in common. So she was definitely aware. And her election to office was seen, as I said, as an extension, as the next step, as part of this civil rights struggle. So he was very appreciative of women like Jordan who took the risk, right, to run for office and to take the struggle into politics.
And I imagine she was like a celebrity, like you write in the book about Muhammad Ali, a young Muhammad Ali coming to visit her.
Yes, because he, again, happened to be in Houston because his trial on drafted, thank you so much, was taking place in Houston. And so right after she is first elected in 1966, he said, I want to meet an important Black Houstonian. And he goes and she is very appreciative of him. And they sign autographs together. Jordan had many facets. She was appreciative of what the Black Power movement offered. She was appreciative of their focus on pride and standing up, right?
But Muhammad Ali was a controversial figure at this time. And it was risky for her to stand next to him and act like and show that they were allies.
I guess so. But I don't think she saw it that way because he was so popular in her community. And she understood that her base was the Black community. She had alliances. She had support from organized labor.
Yeah.
But her base was that Fifth Ward community in Houston. And I think also in interviews that she gave later.
We'll talk more about that when we come back on the other side of this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. She changed the nation, Barbara Jordan's life and legacy in black politics. We're joined by the author of this new book, Mary Ellen Curtin, and she is a professor at American University in Washington, D.C., history, modern African-American history, women's studies, political history. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I'd love to hear from you. If you've got questions, comments, memories, impressions of Barbara Jordan, please share them. Let's listen to another clip. This is from that same speech that she gave at the 1976 the Democratic National Convention. This is where they're nominating Jimmy Carter, who was the last presidential candidate to win in Texas. And so she is speaking about her connection to the Democratic Party.
Our concept of governing is derived from our view of people. It is a concept deeply rooted in a set of beliefs firmly etched in the national conscience of all of us. Now, what are these beliefs? First, we believe in equality for all and privileges for none. This is a belief that each American, regardless of background, has equal standing in the public forum, all of us. Because we believe this idea so firmly, we are an inclusive rather than an exclusive party. Let everybody come. I think it no accident that most of those immigrating to America in the 19th century identified with the Democratic Party. We are a heterogeneous party made up of Americans of diverse backgrounds. We believe that the people are the source of all governmental power, that the authority of the people is to be extended, not restricted.
And we're going to get kind of go in and deconstruct what we just heard there, Mary Ellen Curtin. But first, I'm going to go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. And Jack Morgan is on the line. And Jack?
How you doing?
Okay. What you got?
Well, I used to work at KLRU in Austin from 85 through 89. We were an uplink station, meaning people would come in, we'd just sit them in a chair, and then they would be on the McNeil Lehrer News Hour in Washington, D.C. And she used to come, Molly Ivins used to come. But she came one day and she was in a wheelchair. And she said, I don't really want to be seen in a wheelchair. And we got her a chair and I picked her up out of her wheelchair and put her in the chair. And she did her uplink and I picked her up and put her back in her wheelchair and she left. She was very nice, gracious, thankful. And it was kind of a fun brush with greatness.
All right, Jack, thank you so much for calling in with that memory of you working with Barbara Jordan at the public station in Austin. So we know Barbara Jordan had MS, and she was very private about that, which is why when she did come out and gave the speech during the, what was it, the Bill Clinton She was in a mobility chair, and which it was the first time I'd seen her like that before, and was took an adjustment. So can you talk about, and then we'll get back to the
sure.
cut we just heard.
Yeah, I think you know, she did. She was a very private person, and for a long time she just thought, this is no one else's business but mine. This is my health, my body, my relationship. She was also a gay woman. She did not wish to just talk about that in public either. And so she had a very strong sense of privacy. And, you know, I think, you know, that incident, you know, talks about that. But also after her accident where she nearly drowned and her partner, Nancy Earle, saved her from drowning, information about her MS then became public knowledge. And she, I think it's a process. Anything you read about disability or people who have to come to terms, right, with big changes in their bodies, big changes in their lives, it takes time for that to happen. I don't think she was any different. She's a regular person, you know. She's no different from anyone else who has to come to grips with a huge change in her life. But after that, that became the new normal for her. And she did appear in public in her wheelchair many times and on the national stage at two Democratic conventions, right? And became a spokeswoman, you know, for people with for disabilities in a way that, she, you know, she felt comfortable doing. So I think that's, you know, any incident in her life, any quote, you just always have to step back a bit and put it into context. No one thing, right, says everything. You always have to think about the bigger picture, and that's what I really try and do in the book.
So back to the part of the speech we just heard from the keynote speech, and the thing she said about equality for all and privilege for none.
Yes.
And she delivered that, and it was seen at the time that, well, yeah, of course, that's a given. But now today, where we're hearing from the Supreme Court that is not true, that there is some partial immunity and the former president is given special treatment. I don't know if you could actually say that.
That's right. Well, this is her worst fear. This is why she took such a strong stance against Judge Bork becoming a Supreme Court justice, because she just said, we don't need to be going backward. She actually said that 50 years ago. We need to be going forward. And if you appoint someone like Judge Bork, this is what you're going to get. Someone backward, someone who's going to go backward on voting rights, go backward on women's rights, etc. And so, and Bork, except was the person who actually did do President Nixon's bidding and did fire his attorney general, which no right. one else would do.
The Saturday Night Massacre.
Correct. So, you know, this is her worst, you know, in a way, which she could have predicted in a way, if, you know, this is happening on the Supreme Court, this is what's going to follow. But at the same time, I think she does have optimism. I just want to say that there are a lot of parallels between President Nixon and Trump. I think in her view, both of them violated their oath to uphold the Constitution. They both encouraged, allowed, abetted others who broke the law. They both sought to escape responsibility by using their power as president to shield others. And so, you know, she was very much against, you know, Richard Nixon, even before the Judiciary Committee hearings. And I think, you know, that the conviction that she had that no one should be above the law really pushed her, and also to believe that it was very important that Richard Nixon be held accountable. He was an impediment to progress. He was an impediment to positive change. And I think the same thing, you know, she would say, as your first caller said, about Trump. And I think she would have gone much further in denouncing him.
So the title is She Changed the Nation. And the question is, well, did it change back? I mean, how come we're here?
Right. Well, but then you got Kamala Harris, right? I mean, there's always this tension. And I think that, and the Democratic Party is now emerging, right, to reclaim those ideals that she's talking about, right? Equality for all. This is what we're seeking to achieve. And so we'll see, I guess. But the fact that Kamala Harris, and that we've had such an explosion of Black elected officials at the local, state, and federal level, I think she would take great, you know, solace in that. And see that, you know, really, this is going to take time. There's going to be setbacks, but, you know, and it's not going to happen overnight. You have to chip away at this, but it can, I think she was very firm in her belief that the Democratic Party could be an instrument for change. It's not going to be perfect, and you're always going to have to make some kind of compromises, but you can move in that direction. And so now we'll see, is the nation ready? She said, this cannot be mandated. It's a choice that people have. Do we want a national community of the kind that she talked about, which is inclusive, right? Or not? It's up to the nation.
Let's go back to the Fifth Ward, because I'm fascinated with her story. Where did her spark come from? When did a little girl in the Fifth Ward, you know, you're not allowed to vote. There's no one like you in elected office. There's really, you can't go to, you know, your segregated school system all around you. Mm. How do you decide, I'm going to be the trailblazer? I'm going to change things.
Right, right. Such a great question. I think it's so important that you raise that because we have to understand her community and the institutions that inspired her in segregation. Houston had amazing Black schools, high schools, in that they were people who were dedicated, right, to their students. There was so much talent, so much love, so much commitment to helping the students at those high schools, you know, achieve what they could. She went to Phyllis Wheatley High School, and it's really important to think about the commitment to progressive education. Yes, those schools were not equally funded as the white schools, but the Black teachers there were incredibly inspiring. And in a weird way, the school board, in order to stave off integration, put more money into Black schools. And so the high school that Jordan went to, Phyllis Wheatley, I have to say Jack Yates too, because these were highly competitive schools, really promoted, you know, dreaming among their students. They understood that change was coming, especially with the Cold War in the 1950s, and they thought that there was room for individuals to achieve whatever they could. Right, and teachers really inspired them to do that.
Taking another break. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Mary Ellen Curtin is with us, historian. Her new book is She Changed the Nation, Barbara Jordan's Life and Legacy in Black Politics. I'm going to play one last bit of that same speech, for that keynote address in 1976. Let's give a listen.
We are a party of innovation. We do not reject our traditions, but we are willing to adapt to changing circumstances when change we must. We are willing to suffer the discomfort of change in order to achieve a better future. We have a positive vision of the future founded on the belief that the gap between the promise and reality of America can one day be finally closed. We believe that. This, my friends, is the bedrock of our concept of governing. This is a part of the reason why Americans have turned to the Democratic Party. These are the foundations upon which a national community can be built.
So she was very partisan. She believed in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, and she fought for the Democratic Party and helped try to get others elected. Why was she, like, there was still some ambivalence at the time, but people still wasn't really clear, because the Democratic Party, even in her lifetime, worked so hard to keep her from voting and even holding office.
Right. So your question is about, you know, in a way, how could she be part of this party that tried to exclude her? Right.
Yeah.
And not just her, but, you know, if you know your history, the party that upheld segregation tenaciously, right, in the South. It's the party of was the Democrats. It's the party also of George Wallace, etc. Well, this is a time of transition. And again, people like Jordan and Shirley Chisholm in the North are really encouraging people to say, you have to risk belief in American democracy. And in the South, hey, the Democratic Party is the only primary that's worth winning. A lot of people talked about forming a third party, right? Or, you know, maybe we should, you know, maybe the Republicans, the emerging Republicans. There was a group of Black Houstonians who really did like, for example, John Connolly. But Jordan was very adamant. and her belief that there was room, that with Black voters, you know, who could leverage their vote, there was room for the party to change. Not everyone agreed with that. A lot of people thought Lyndon Johnson, Vietnam, right? Foreign policy, this party is too corrupt. You know, it cannot be redeemed. But she disagreed, respectfully. And she encouraged people to use the Black vote as a leveraging power to change it. And that was her belief. Not everyone agreed with that.
But she felt it was their best bet, you know.
Exactly.
You had to pick between the two major parties. Of course, there was a Black Liberation Party effort. Mm-hmm. And
right.
In Texas, we had Raza Unida, which was an effort. And she recognized how Mexican-Americans had been disenfranchised and worked to expand the Voting Rights Act to include Texas and protect Mexican-Americans. But it was like she thought the Democratic Party, because it was the most open to to new membership and new voices, even though so many setbacks.
Right. And then again, here's an echo here with Frederick Douglass. She would have said, paraphrasing him, the Democratic Party is the ship, all else is the sea. It's what we've got. And we better work, you know, it's the best chance we have. And yes, absolutely, she wanted to encourage, expand the Voting Rights Act to encourage all language minorities and include Texas. And that had a real impact.
Let's go to another caller, Randall. Randall, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I'm glad that you mentioned her work on behalf of immigrants and so forth. One of the last things that she did in her life was the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform. You know, she was appointed by President Clinton to head that commission in 1994. And it's disturbingly sad that this groundbreaking, intelligent, common sense body of common sense has just sat there collecting dust. It's a 1,000-page paperweight. It seems like it's never been looked at. How did that happen? I'm kind of like, you know, why? Because she had some. I have not read the entire 1,000-page report, but she gave some testimony before two or three different subcommittees. Right before she died, and some of her words just ring so true.
Randall, thank you for the call. But I should point out that Donald Trump has quoted Barbara Jordan saying that her vision of she was anti-immigration, he says, and that they would agree on that.
Well, he's absolutely 1,000% wrong. Okay, it's not the first time Donald Trump has mischaracterized someone's views. There couldn't be two more different perspectives on immigration than Barbara Jordan and Donald Trump. Just listen to the quote. She said, we are a nation of immigrants, right? That we embrace we embrace immigration. She saw immigration as something positive for the nation. She's against racism in all of its forms. She thought America should be proud of this immigrant community and certainly would have rejected any idea of using it as a way to promote racism and nationalism. That commission is a very complicated story because it is a bipartisan commission. It has her name on it, but she was brought in after she retired from Congress because it was understood that legislation is about no one gets 100% of what they want. And so people who were very conservative, who opposed all immigration and others who wanted all, you know, open borders had to work together. And that was part of her genius, really, was getting people to sit down and talk to each other and hammering out, what do we share? What are the principles that we share? Where can we agree? What can we put forward? And it is a very extensive document, but some, you know, important things is that Jordan promoted, she would never have supported the breakup of families. She thought that immigration should be based on upholding, keeping families together. And she was believed that there had to be a backlog, had to be, for refugees, that had to be dealt with. I mean, there are some numbers there, but she didn't support any kind of quota. She said these numbers have to be revisited every couple years. We have to be flexible about immigration. We have to work with other countries. We have to cooperate with other countries in order to get this right. So I agree with your caller. There's a lot in that document, which is very important and significant, and it's a shame. She died very young. She was only 59 when she died. She was in the middle of testifying before Congress. And then because the because she had such a moral authority, it was seen that she had the power to bring together Democrats and Republicans on this issue. But with her death, there was really no one to take her place. And this issue, President Clinton shelved that report.
She was also opposed to Washington, D.C., finding statehood, achieving statehood. You work in Washington, D.C. It's now something people are hoping will come about. She felt on constitutional grounds that it was not something that, that should happen. You know, would she still feel that way today?
I don't know. I mean, she changed, you know, people change their mind. Even Barbara Jordan would have changed her mind, I think. You have to, again, remember the context, I think, when she probably made some of those statements. In the late 80s, there was a lot of instability in the government of D.C., to put it mildly. And I think
I was living there at the time with Marion Barry days.
Right. And so I think that was a way, perhaps, of not directly you know, just saying, look, this is true that the founders did not envision, right, a city, you know, with residents, it would be mostly, you know, government offices and people would be loyal to other states. Given the changes that have happened since then, I think she would be more open because she understood, you know, the importance of representation, democracy, and, you know, D.C. residents having a voice. Certainly home rule she supported. Statehood, like, you could see it as a different issue. But like all these things, you can always pull out a quote from Jordan, perhaps, and say, well, wait, what does she mean there? And I would always say, let's look at the context. Why is she saying this? At this time, in this place, I think that's an important thing to consider.
But she was solid and never wavering about her commitment to the Constitution. And as we've discovered today, that you know, that her words ring true today, or maybe even truer than when she first said them. Why is it not being more upfront these days?
You mean in terms...
Why aren't we hearing these speeches and replaying? Right. They should be on Spotify.
I agree. I think, you know, I'm hoping to bring this back. I think, you know, it's interesting, like when you were playing those clips, your listeners might not remember, but those pauses, some of them are strategic, but those were also the standing ovations during that speech. This is the reason why she paused. That speech, she spoke for 24 minutes, she got over 20 standing ovations. So, you know, she is a master at communicating and inspiring, you know, her audience on whether it's TV, Madison Square Garden, which is where she gave that speech, smaller settings. She really always understood her audience and was very good at inspiring. I think, you know, that the focus is it should be on Kamala Harris. I think that, you know, Shirley Chisholm was an incredibly important figure. Jordan looked up to Chisholm. They worked together. I think it's just that people can't hold more than one black woman politician in their head, you know, more for longer periods. And we need to understand the significant role that black women have played in all levels.
Even today, holding our elections. Making sure that we have a democracy that works.
Right. And organizing and running for office and all of those facets. Black women have been at the forefront of this.
All right. We're so out of time. But Mary Ellen Curtin, thank you so much. She Changed the Nation, Barbara Jordan's Life and Legacy in Black Politics is the book. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.